Welcome to the Mustang Owners Podcast. And now your host, Steve Hall.
Welcome to the Mustang Owners Podcast. My name is Steve Hall. I'm the Executive Director of the Mustang Owners Museum. And today we have a very special guest that's going to be with us. He is actually the Ford Global Design Director, which is as you can imagine, I have to say, is a very big title with a lot of responsibility. But I'd like to welcome Joel Piotrkowski to our podcast. Joel, welcome.
Hi, Steve. It's great to be here with you guys.
Well, we're looking forward to chatting with you. I know you had quite a bit of work from our earlier conversations with the 2015, so I'd like to kind of focus on that because, of course, that's a car that is still going strong with our hobby enthusiasts. And obviously, it's, you know, translated into Shelby's and Mach 1s. And so it's got a great lineage of cars from starting from 2015. But I'd like to just start with kind of right off the bat. It's like when starting to do a new generation, such as the 2015, when did the program start when you had to look at design? And does design start first or engineering, or how does that work together?
Yeah, it's a great question, Steve, and certainly for your audience who probably doesn't have much insight into the inner workings of the auto industry. Really starts with some of the planning and being able to plan out when is a new model, new vehicle coming into the cycle plan. And then once that's determined, then if there is a vehicle architecture that's not in place, then there's some very early upfront vehicle architecture work. And by vehicle architecture, what I'm speaking about is the powertrain, the chassis, all the hardware, the underbody structure, and then also the assembly plant that it's going to go into. And then once that's determined, then vehicle engineering engages with the vehicle architecture team and the design organization gets involved as well. And we start laying out all the hard points, if you will. You know, what's going to create the footprint size of the vehicle, the profile of the vehicle, interior, exterior details and components, and really start kind of putting the pieces of the puzzle in place. And then also at the same time, the marketing teams are working to identify the customer, their specific needs as we look to the forward-looking vehicle that we're going to be working on and developing. And then it all kind of comes together as a cross-functional team to start creating, in this case, the 2015 Mustang. So we were probably really thoroughly engaged in the design development in early 2011. So we had customer briefs from the marketing team. We had the vehicle architecture set up. Actually, it wasn't set up completely. We were going through the process of setting it up because as we we were transitioning from the S197 into the S550. It was all new architecture. We were reproportioning the vehicle dramatically to really change up the overall aesthetic stance and emotional appeal of the 2015. So it was a real cross-functional effort, passionate people up down throughout the team Mustang to really get it to work. As the architecture was coming together and we were working with the engineering community and the marketing teams were in the background also sketching and developing theme ideation that would then go into creating two-dimensional drawings, renderings, and then those would lead into scale models, scale clay models that we develop here in the studios. And then those ultimately, we go through a design selection process and then start narrowing down the themes that we can start to focus on as we move into full-size clay model development. We had teams across the world originally sketching on Mustang, then it started narrowing down and we brought all those sketches and back to Dearborn. Some of our team out in Irvine, California, and our advanced studio was supporting as well. So real team effort. And ultimately we designed and developed a vehicle here in Dearborn, Michigan, where all the Mustangs have been designed and developed. So that's kind of the high level flyby. Hopefully it wasn't too confusing, but certainly can help you break that down if you want.
Sure. Well, and I will get into a little bit. I thought it was interesting. You talked about how the designs were actually cultivated out of different design houses from, like, or you mentioned Irvine and other areas. I recently had gotten across some information when they did the very first Mustang, which of course was Gail Halderman's design was picked. But I found out that they had done a couple of other designs from Lincoln. And there was another Ford team that did a design. So there was just, but then back in those days, they didn't have probably the international aspect or connection that you know, is available today. So those folks pretty much, when I talked with Gail about his design, he said his design was something unique and different, but yet he's still in the C post. It is a Lincoln, it is inspired by Lincoln Continental. And so I guess my point is there, of course, their aspirations or their designs are all something centered around what they were already doing in Detroit, where now, of course, you have a group of folks around the world that are going to have probably different visions and looks that you're able to draw from, which are going to obviously, I think, will probably help the design, give you more things to look at and kind of create something, especially with the Mustang now becoming a more global platform. That's interesting to hear that it was done that way.
Yeah, and, just to be clear, what we like to do with all of our programs is to, we often do what we call a sketch blitz, and we open up the sketch blitz to our global teams, and it's really interesting to see what global design studios within Ford Motor Company, how they think about, say, if, for example, obviously Mustang or F-150, specifically because they may not be familiar with the brand, but ultimately we designed the S550, the 2015 Mustang here in Dearborn. What's good about getting input just from our global design team is we get inspired by some of the trends, some of the different thoughts that might be happening. But ultimately we're the stewards here in Dearborn of creating that Mustang formula, that aesthetic that our customers know and love. We knew we were taking a bit of a risk on the 2015. It was stretching a lot. It was new proportions, but we really felt passionate about what we ended up with. Obviously, the success of the vehicle speaks volumes, and it's really exciting to be part of a cross-functional team that carries on and brought in the 50th anniversary Mustang for the world to enjoy, quite frankly. And it that was really our first Ford Motor Company's first global Mustang.
Well, I will tell you from the enthusiast aspect, it was probably one of the more anticipated Mustangs that came out. Of course, there's all kinds of rumors, which obviously is going to happen in the car world. They're going to have somebody has some piece of information that they try to share, and it kind of gets expanded on a little bit. Or I should say little liberties are taken with it. I was actually one of the directors with Mustang Club of America, worked closely with Jim Owens. That's how I got to know Jim Owens a little bit better. The opportunity to have the 2015 on hand, we had the anniversary edition on hand, and it was just phenomenal. It was, it was what everybody was looking for, and I don't know of anybody that had any kind of concerns about the car. They loved it because they thought it was the next step forward, and I think they were happy considering, like you said, the fifth generation car was quite different from the third and the fourth. It kind of went back to some of its earlier roots, and now the sixth generation seemed to be a more futuristic extension. So there was a lot of excitement and pleasure to see the work that was done. So I'd have to say, from what I could tell, it was a home run as far as that, because I know that, like you said, there's a lot of pieces that you guys do certainly take a look at to make sure it happens. Well, let's get on into a couple more specific questions. I know you kind of answered about this to a degree because of the design centers, but how many different designs do you look at or renderings do you actually look at? I mean, is it in the 20s, 50s, 100 different renderings? When you start to look at a 2015 model, how many do you actually start to kind of look through?
Yeah, there are hundreds of proposals submitted. And it's not that they're submitted all at once, but there's a kind of what we call a coarse to fine approach to how we design any of our vehicles, quite frankly, where we do at the very early stages a lot of visual bandwidth. And we create designs that really span the gamut of mild to wild, if you will. From that, we discuss, we look at it through a customer lens and, you know, the input that we've learned from customers. But at the same time, you know, what is our natural gut instinct as a company and a design organization to say, yes, these are the themes that we feel strongly about that represent a future Mustang. And, you know, these perhaps, although they look great, perhaps they're not as progressive or they're a little too retro for where we want to take the next generation Mustang. So then from there, you know, we kind of narrow down some of those themes, and then the design teams continue to work refining some of those themes, expanding on those in some cases. And it's a continual effort. If you think of a funnel, Steve, it's you know, wide at the top and next down to the bottom, or an hourglass, where, you know, it kind of goes from very coarse and broad at the top and necking down to the base. And that's ultimately what we end up doing with any of our designs in program development. But again, it's a very exciting dynamic process. It's at least 99.5% of the work that gets generated ends up on the cutting room floor, as they say.
Well, I can imagine, especially if, like you say, we have hundreds of renderings to look at. So you have these renderings, you've kind of, as you say, they've been funneled down to a few. And I would hear from my thought is that the next step would be you start to look at some of these and see how they start to form onto a clay model. Or do you still narrow it down further before you go to clay model? Or how does that then translate to the clay model?
It's they're almost like a dual path, if you will. Certainly, we start with the design renderings and sketch ideation, also the proportions of the vehicle. Sometimes we will even create a proportional model, just a generic proportional model to be sure that what we've been developing in the upfront early work is proportionally what we think is the best direction. And then as the sketch renderings are ongoing, we start, in the case of the 2015, we started doing scale clay models from multiple themes. And, you know, we've probably had at least 8 or 10 scale theme models, if not more. And, you know, those also go through a kind of a funneling process. But it's happening in conjunction with the 2D sketches. So they're working side by side, hand in hand, the designers creating the sketch themes. They're working with the clay modeling and digital modeling teams to interpret those into either digital or clay models that we evaluate. And again, it's this funneling down process. And, you know, we have various reviews throughout the timeline, the developmental timeline of the program, where we discuss, obviously, amongst ourselves, but also with the senior leadership of the company, our process, our thought, and how we want to get to one final design theme.
I'm just taking all this in. This is so cool. As far as, of course, you're working with the tabletops, and you do start, as you say, they kind of funnel down, and you get to a process where, okay, now you're ready for a full size. How long does it take to do a full size model? I know we have some pictures, and it's just amazing to look at that and say that's a full size model. What kind of time frame does that take to create something like that?
So with a full size clay model, Steve, what we do, we have what we call armatures, and it's you know, just some steel that's built up to a form, and then on top of that we put plywood, and on top of that we put white styrofoam. That's kind of built to an overall profile or shape of the design theme. And with our technologies of digital milling, where we have large 5-axis milling machines, 3-axis and 5-axis milling machines, we're able to then mill down or mill back the white styrofoam to say about anywhere from 3 to 5 inches under what we think is going to be our final surface, just directionally our final surface. And then from there, clay, our modeling clay in the studios here is then applied to that foam armature. And then it's built up in layers to a point where there's enough clay on there that we can then use our digital math models, put it on the milling machines, and have the milling machines then mill back those digital surfaces into the clay. So that sounds like a bit of a mouthful. Let me just touch base with you and see if you got that kind of formulated in your head.
No, I do. But again, I'll have to say I'm maybe a bit of an advantage because, of course, we have some photos of previous from 2015 on the machine, as it were, showing with how it's being milled and how it's being structured as such. And then, of course, we have some photos of a little bit more finished. It's still a clay model, of course, but it's a little bit more finished, where the wheels have been attached, little accent pieces. You can start to, it starts to shape, take more and more of that shape. So right. I do follow you. But when you were saying that, I will say this, the question that popped in my head was, how much does that thing weigh? Because it's got to be pretty heavy.
Well, clay is very heavy. Obviously, the steel armature that we use is quite robust. Yeah. So the clay models do weigh more than physical cars. Yes.
Yeah, it had to. I guess they don't roll very well, do they? So I that was what I was actually thinking when you were going through that. So that's interesting. One of the things I've learned is that, of course, when you did the 2015 model, you also do a full size interior. It's in clay, and that's one thing I can say from our photos that we share with our guests. They go, they had no idea. I think it's more of an afterthought. They had no idea about the interior design. That, you know, they think about the exterior, but then to find out that there's a full clay interior, and it's done in clay and processed. So that was very interesting. So if you don't mind, I'd like to hear a little bit how that progresses or how that starts, but then of course it's got to get matched into the car so that the interior will fit inside the exterior that's being designed. They got to work together, of course, but I'd like to hear a little bit more how that works hand in hand with the design.
Yeah, that's also a pretty interesting process for those that haven't experienced a professional design studio. So yes, similar to the exterior clay model process, we do similar on the interior. However, the interior armature is kind of inside out, more like a bathtub, if you will. And we typically will work from the B pillar of the car forward. So from the end of the front door forward is what we will focus on initially. And that includes the instrument panel, driver and passenger side door, center console. And then we use surrogate seats, typically seats that are already in production that we can put in place while the seats are being designed in a different studio or department. But with the clay model interior, similar process where we have armature that's built up with, in this case, we use aluminum rigging, wood, and styrofoam, as previously mentioned, on the exterior. And then of course, adding the clay on top of that styrofoam. And then we do the mill back of the surfaces that have been generated. Again, that same coarse defined sketch design process that we did on the exterior is happening equally at the same time on the interior. Once we get it roughed out into the clay model, you know, we can mill very, very fine details, or we can leave it a little more rough or loose, if you will, so that the design team and the clay modelers can go in and manipulate the clay as they see fit to balance proportions, to change the surfaces that you see on the instrument panel. Look at all the details, the components, how they all fit together. We also do use a lot of 3D printing to create our interior components and even exterior components. And if you can imagine, we have a design team that's focusing on these components, both interior and exterior. So they are simultaneously working together to design the components, the knobs, the screens, the steering wheel, the shifter, the door release pulls, headlights, taillights, road wheels, grill mesh details. And we will develop those components, again, going through a 2D course defined process, and then create those digitally with math modeling. And then from that math model, we're able to send it to a 3D printer to create those hard parts that we can then place into the clay model. And that goes for, again, interior and exterior components. So we'll actually carve out a footprint of a knob to put into the interior clay. We have a three-dimensional steering wheel that will mount onto a steering column that's part of the interior clay model buck. So you can really, once you start, you can really detail out the entire interior clay model, start making it look real. And we will finish these hard parts. We will paint them. We will plate them in chrome finishes if we want to use chrome or a satin chrome. We have a really unique process to wrap the interiors. So the instrument panel, for example, that's typically black in your car. We have molds that we've developed that have a grain in them. And it's a big flat sheet about the size of a desktop, if you will. And our shops are able to pour a liquid acrylic into that textured mold. And they build up layers, so it becomes about, let's say, 2 to 3 millimeters thick. And once that cures, they're able to peel it out of the mold, and it becomes almost like a piece of leather that they can then adhere onto the clay model, which then gives you the impression of a grained texture and painted finish on the instrument panel, on the doors, on the console, everything that you see in the interior. So we go to great depths to really detail out our models. So it has a very high fidelity, and we're able to then really visualize those models in three dimensions and have reviews with our management teams. It's an exciting process to watch it all come together and be a part of it.
No, I can imagine as I'm listening to this, and it makes me kind of think about, well, exterior and interior design teams, they're separate. They're not the same guys or ladies doing the work. It's the different guys, different people doing it, and same with the modelers. But which takes longer, or which is a little bit more difficult to kind of get to a final point with? Because, of course, both are extremely important to, of course, make sure that the aesthetics, as you say, is going to resonate to the hobby and the car buyers. But is it traditionally the exterior a little bit more difficult to make sure you get it right compared to the interior? What's more difficult, interior or exterior?
It's hard to say one versus the other, because it's very dependent on a number of variables, Steve. Certainly the exterior it's a very emotional, and when you've got something that's 50 years successful in the marketplace, everyone is very focused on that vehicle, equally on the interior. So as we were developing the 2015, there was passion on both exterior and interior design development. And I think the most difficult element is coming down to the final design selection to say this is the right thing to do for the car, because sometimes there are a couple really great design themes that have been proposed right up to the time that we have to make a decision on what we want to take forward and continue developing that final design. That becomes the biggest challenge, I would say, because you can argue one way or the other, but I think ultimately what it comes down to is it right for the brand? Is it right for the customer? And then is it futured enough from a design standpoint? So those are the things we really take into consideration as we make our ultimate design selections. And it's even if you have two or three different design themes at the final time of design selection, final theme selection. It's a really passionate time for the company to make this this final decision. You can imagine such a passionate vehicle like Mustang, how that energy comes out in such reviews, and it's it really just shows the strength of the brand internally, and the passion that the collective Ford organization has to be sure that we continue shepherding on a great brand into the future for all the right reasons.
The times I've been up there, and I do sense that the design team members that I have met, they are certainly, they do take it personally, so to speak. It is a passion to them that they want to make sure they get it right. Above all else, is making sure that they are continuing the legacy and the heritage of Mustang. So it's very personal, and it's overwhelming to hear that or see that, because as a Mustang enthusiast, you want to know that the guys who are taking care of in this generation and the future generations, they're just as passionate. They're not just going to give you a car because it's a car. They want to give you something that's going to, you know, that's going to continue that passion and that connection that we as Mustang enthusiasts already have. It's been interesting as we, you know, we talked with Steve Ling a while about a month or so ago, and he, you know, he expressed many of the same comments that you've did. How important it is for them personally to make sure they do it right, because this is something that's important. As of course for a brand, for Ford, but it's also important for the enthusiasts. And so they do take it very personal. They really want to go to the nth degree to make sure it's exactly that next generation vehicle. So it certainly comes out and shows that. Well, let me ask then, if you know, you talked about how you kind of start the conversation back in 2011. When does the design of the car finally kind of get locked in? It's okay, that's it. It's done. We're not doing anything else to it. Of course, you want to debut it in 2014 in this case, because it's a year before, but you want to kind of get it out there for the 50th. So when does the designs or that part kind of, okay, we're done, we're set, that's it. When does that get done?
Yeah, well, you know, we have timelines for all of our programs at Ford Motor Company. And, you know, we're kind of set up to meet certain milestones within that timeline. Each program differs in, you know, how much time is spent in the early upfront design phase, but you know, once we get to a design selection, that's, you know, we started in about 2000, early 2011 in earnest, and I think it was about mid 2012 we were locked into a design theme, and then from locking in, that doesn't mean we're finished. That means now we really start finessing, refining, making sure we're meeting all the engineering specifications for production and the tolerances that are needed. Continuous development of all the components, both exterior and interior. The, you know, endless amounts of refinement that continue to go into the final development of a vehicle once design themes are selected. And you know, that's easily 8 to 12 months of refinement once a design theme is selected, at least on the 2015. So it's it seems like a long time, but it goes by so quickly. And you know, sometimes we run into barriers or problems where, you know, manufacturing might have an issue with how parts or pieces come together, so we have to reassess how we design and those parts. You know, we have to make changes to surfaces to clear certain tolerances of the underbody, or say for example a hood hinge. You know, hood hinges and door hinges are particularly challenging, and it cause a lot of churn sometimes to really get the body side surface right to accommodate door hinges. Just little things like that. You know, I think the general public probably wouldn't even think about, but it all has to happen at some point in time. And this is the part in the design process where all really comes together, you know, really is bringing all the functions together and making sure that design can go down the assembly line.
You just actually went right into my next question. let's say the very first 2015 is coming down the assembly line. Do you and the team go out to take a look at it and say, well, let's see what it looks like, or did it function through as expected? I mean, I know I would be too excited not to want to do that, but I'm just kind of curious, do you guys kind of say, well, the first one's coming down today, let's go take a look at it. So do you do that?
Absolutely, Steve. We have what we call a pilot plant, and that pilot plant is actually a dedicated facility where they do pre-production work. So there's a miniature assembly line kind of working out some of the processes, bringing all the early prototype parts into this pilot plant to start assembling them onto our first vehicles. And these first vehicles are the vehicles that end up being seen on the road in camouflage. So I think we're all familiar with spy photography.
Sure.
Those spy photo shots are more often than not these early prototype vehicles that have been built in this pilot plant that we have.
Okay.
So as before they even get down the road, though, you're absolutely correct. We're down in the pilot plant, watching, looking, reviewing all the parts, all the sheet metal forming, all the highlights on the sheet metal, just to be sure that it's meeting our a final design intent. And it's a super exciting process. And it really happens quickly from the time that we release surfaces of our final design theme to the time the tool manufacturers and suppliers are able to return parts back to the company to start looking at prototype parts, and then ultimately how they then fit onto the early assembly in the pilot plants. Yes.
Well, I know we've been going for quite a bit here, and I really appreciate your time, but two more quick questions. One that we spoke about a little bit before we started is I'd love to hear you tell our audience the passion that the Mustang world has for their Mustang, but you have to look at it from a little bit of a different eye, that when you see these cars on the road or you go to a car show and you see the passion, I'd like to get an idea how you feel, how that resonates to you, because not every, you know, it's important, because like I said, these people, the people that have Mustangs, they love them. They become family members in many cases. But how does that affect you? How do you, when you see that, what's your feeling? How does that stir you?
Yeah, Steve, it's really, really hard to describe those feelings. You know, it's something I started my career off always wanting to do, to be a part of the greater good, to bring joy to people's lives through the automobile. I've got a family history, so I've been exposed to this throughout my life, and I knew it was something that I wanted to do from a very young age. You know, I've been in the industry now for going on 32 years, and I've had the opportunity to work on some amazing vehicles. And what's really exciting is to see customers. So, for example, Mustang customers, how passionate they are for the work that the design organization that I'm part of, Ford Motor Company, who's delivering these vehicles to the customers, how excited and passionate those customers are, and what they do to their vehicles, how they customize them, how they appreciate them, how they collect them. And, you know, what's also fascinating too is, you know, the 2015, as mentioned earlier, was really the first global Mustang to be in countries far beyond our shores, and see Mustangs in a different context in Europe, in China, in Australia, in South America. It's absolutely sensational to see the passion and the joy and fulfillment our customers get from you know, their experience and ownership of having these vehicles. And it's such a blessing to be part of an organization like this, and have had the opportunity to work on such an incredible vehicle that is the best-selling sports car in the world, and brings joy to so many customers worldwide. It's indescribable.
I can appreciate that, because I know that the owners appreciate the work that Ford and his members and his team Mustang members do, because it shows. It really does. It just shows in what we end up having as each year comes out, or the next Mach 1 or the GT500. They're proud to be Mustang owners. They are proud of what Ford has done and what Ford listens to them. I think that's something else that I'm not saying. I don't know about other car companies, so I can't speak of them, but I do know that the feeling is that Ford listens to the owners. There's been history in the way back regarding Mustang and the enthusiasts and the conversations that went on and what happened from there that a lot of us, you know, everybody knows about, but it's just that Ford does listen. And so that way they feel that they also have ownership of the product. And so that's what makes Mustang what it is. So we appreciate it and thank you. Well, I always like to wrap up with some fun kind of quick questions. And that is, sure. I already know part of the answer. I don't know if I know all the answer, but what kind of Mustang do you have?
Oh, I've got a Shelby in the garage, a GT350R.
Did you have a chance to go do a track day?
I had the absolute blessing to do a track day down at Charlotte Motor Speedway with the GT350 Track Attack. That was an absolute riot to be on the Roval, really experiencing the car for what it was designed to do. And it was just smile ear to ear. Went by so quick, but to have that opportunity to drive the Roval, be on the embankments and the corners, go through the chicane, and just let it rip was absolutely phenomenal.
Well, it must be.
And to hear that voodoo motor just scream and wail,
yes,
like it was designed to do, yeah, music to your ears.
Well, that's what had to be kind of interesting. While you're the one-day course there, you're sitting there and you're going, you know, I helped build some of this stuff. I helped design some of this stuff. I have some of my DNA in this. And so it had to be really kind of a unique experience. Did you do the ride where you had one of the instructors ride and you got to go as a passenger?
Yeah, that was at the very end of our session. And that was just eye-popping, blisteringly quick. something that, you know, I could never do myself. And it was just such a great experience to be with a professional driver in that car, pushing it to its limits and really feeling what it was capable of doing.
Yeah, I think it was Jim Owens that coined the phrase. I'm not 100% sure, but there was the wash. When you have a professional driver and you're strapped in as the passenger, you get the washing machine effect. And that is, of course, while they're going and what have you, you find yourself, because of the G's, you're moving around and such. And of course, at those speeds, that's a little extreme. But they're very good over there. And like you said, it's quite an experience. And so it's something that, you know, you hope more and more people, and I know the team over there who does the driving school, they do a great job. We have a lot of people who go to that driving school. They'll come over to the museum either the day before or the day after. And the ones that come over the day after, they still have the biggest grin on their face. It's like, you know, it's almost like they think about that driving school is such a neat aspect. But again, I bring that up for the purposes. I don't know of any other car company that will let you buy a performance vehicle and then says, we are going to have you get yourself here, but you get a free day on the track with professionals. There's no one else that does that. I mean, it's just like, oh, you got that car. Well, here's your keys. Go have fun. Read the owner's manual. Be sure you read it so you know what you're doing. Bye-bye. Where Ford actually will sit and say, okay, you've got a 350, you've got a 500, or you've got a Mach 1. They want you to understand that what that experience should be, not just use it as a car to drive around a little bit or take your kids to school. It's a performance vehicle. Enjoy it as a performance vehicle, which leads me to the question, how often do you drive your GT350R?
Well, Steve, I don't drive it as often.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. And I know you're in Detroit, so weather sometimes can be a factor.
It is. I don't drive it nearly as often as I would like to. It's an amazing vehicle. I also have the opportunity to take cars home from work, and they're just a blast to drive. And it's a shame sometimes that they really live and thrive on a track environment, and it's almost hard to drive them on the street because they just want to go. And I'm sure many of your your listeners will know and have had the experience of perhaps dipping a little bit too hard into the right accelerator pedal. But that's, yeah. It just brings a smile to your face. Mustang is a visceral experience. No matter what Mustang you have, it's visual, it's audible, it's G-forces, it's sensation, it's wind in your hair if you have a convertible. It's the pleasure of, as you leave the car, you look back over your shoulder and say, wow, that's my Mustang. Oh. It brings a smile to you.
We have people who will loan us their Mustang, of course, and so the car is out of the garage for a period of time, and when they come back to get it, the wife will pull me aside, and she'll say, you have no idea how many times he went out to the garage to look at his car because he forgot you had it. they just want to go look at their car just to go see it. So you're right. Everything you've said is actually right on target. Absolutely correct. Well, with that, I'm going to wrap it up because I really appreciate the time. I know we probably went a little longer than 30 minutes. This is something that I know our like I said earlier, our listeners are going to really thoroughly enjoy listening because this is the kind of information, the passion that they like to get. I mean, they really do. And to be able to talk with part of the team that makes that happen is just going to be phenomenal for them. So thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure and honor to represent Ford Motor Company and Ford Design in this little chat we've had, Steve. And hopefully we'll get the invite to come back on and we can talk about the other Mustang in the stable called the Mustang Mach-E. And that's a great story on itself as well.
And we definitely will. I know as I'm going through the conversation, I realize there's just so many other things that we could talk about. You're absolutely right. I appreciate that. It's a good idea. We will do that. So again, thank you very much, and we'll talk soon. We hope you've enjoyed listening to another episode of the Mustang Owners Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you won't miss any episodes. For more information on the museum, please go to MustangOwnersMuseum.com and you'll find additional information on upcoming events.